Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 30. We're going to call this chapter, David's Wives Are Captured by the Amalekites. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we see David marching up way up to the north in the Jezreel Valley with the Philistines in order to attack Saul. David being in a bad situation because Achish, the king of Gath, was using him on his side as a defector from Israel, but the other leaders of Gath, the other Philistines, didn't believe David could be trusted, so they sent him back home to Ziklag. And so that's where we are now, in Ziklag, way to the southwest of Israel in the Philistine plain down there. And so we start now with verses 1 and 2. Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag, and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. Now the third day when David got back, that could either be from the third day that the Philistines had set out from Gath to go up to the Jezreel Valley, Shunem, Aphek, the places where they mustered up there, or where they gathered together to fight the Israelites. Could have been from the time the Philistines set out from Gath, or it could have been from the time that David had left the Philistine army while they were up there at Aphek in the Jezreel Valley, or at Jezreel, wherever they were. They were in several places. It could have been those 3 days. And, of course, remember, third day is part of one day, full second day, part of the third day, so it's not an entire three-day journey. Could be, but not necessarily. But at any rate, it was a long way to Ziklag, from way up there in the north to way down there in the southwest. And so it took David a while to get back. When he got back, he saw that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev. The Negev is the whole south country down there at the southern edge of Israel and below the southern edge of Israel. Ziklag is down in that area, and he finds out that his town had been overthrown, burned with fire. He also noticed that all of his women were captive, all who were in it, both small and great. The old men, of course, all the soldiers had gone off to fight with David, 600 of them, but the old men, any old men and any women and any children, they're all gone. Pretty distressing sight. Now, the good news for David was is that all these citizens of Ziklag, which belonged to David, none of them were killed. David was lucky when he raided all of the towns that he raided, including the camps of the Amalekites. He raided Geshur in the Golan Heights. He raided Gezer, which was to the north of Ekron there. And he also was said to have raided the Amalekites. And when he raided the Amalekites, he killed them all, women and children. Now, why were the Amalekites so nice? Adam Clark speculates that perhaps these Amalekites had not heard yet of what David had done. I find that hard to believe. So in other words, this raid on Ziklag was just a random raid along with the other raids the Amalekites were doing. But Jameson Foster Brown said, no, the raid was in particular a retaliation for David's raids. I believe that. I think that makes more sense. But then the next question arises is, why did they not kill anybody in Ziklag? Now, the Amalekites weren't humanitarians. John Gill says they wanted to sell the survivors for slaves. That makes sense. Maybe they wanted to keep some of the women for wives. That makes sense. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the old people who were taken from Ziklag were spared out of respect to their age. And I find that hard to believe. This is surprising because you're not going to be able to sell an old person for a slave, you wouldn't think. Not very valuable. They're not very valuable. You got to feed them. It's amazing to me they didn't kill them. So I speculate that maybe the Amalekites were afraid of further retaliation by David. If they started killing the captives, including the old people, then David would say, okay, there's no point in negotiating with you people. I'm just going to come after you. And David is a pretty fierce dude to be dealing with. So maybe that's what the Amalekites were thinking. Maybe we better go easy here. He destroyed our cities once, and we destroyed his city, but maybe he can come back and do it again. At any rate, they left them all alive for whatever reason. So we go now to verses 3 and 6 of 1 Samuel 30. When David and his men came to the city, that's Ziklag. Behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. That Jezreelitess, that doesn't mean she's up there in the valley of Jezreel. There's another Jezreel to the south east of Hebron. And, of course, Abigail is the famous Abigail, the wood of Nabal, the fool, the Carmelite. That Carmel is down there south, about 5 or 6 miles on the road southeast from Hebron at the intersection of the road that runs straight east to En Gedi on the shores of the Dead Sea. So we've already talked about these two wives in a previous chapter. They're gone now. They're captured by the Amalekites. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. You would think he'd be more distressed about losing his wives, but I don't know, when people are about to stone you to death, you might not think about your wives so much. Now, why would David's people threaten to stone David? This massacre perpetrated by the Amalekites was totally out of David's control. Well, maybe the men of Ziklag, David's men, maybe they thought the Amalekites wanted revenge by raiding their towns. So, doggone it, David, maybe you shouldn't have attacked the Amalekites. Well, that's hindsight. And notice the men who were thinking about stoning David, they'd enjoyed the plunder from those Amalekite towns. They didn't complain about it then. So it seems to me, to be hard to blame David for the Amalekite raid. Or it could be perhaps the men of Ziklag, of David's troops, were so overwhelmed by grief they just weren't thinking straight. And so they wanted revenge. They wanted a scapegoat. They were going to go get David. Maybe the men of Ziklag thought, look, you took us up with Achish to the Philistines to the north in the Jezreel Valley to attack King Saul, but by doing that you left Ziklag defenseless. You shouldn't have gone up with Achish to fight Saul in the Jezreel Valley. Well, but in David's defense on that point, he was forced to go up there by Achish because Achish said, I want you to go, you need to go, and if he'd have said no, his loyalty to the Philistines would have been questioned and his cover most probably would have been blown. He had no choice to go up there. But as you see, on all this period of running from Saul, David is on the edge. He has very few options. He's constantly caught on the horns of a dilemma between the rock and the hard place. He's constantly having to depend upon the providence of God in order to escape. And so it would be real easy for somebody in Ziklag, one of David's men, to say, oh, you shouldn't have gone up to the Philistines, but no, David had no choice. But now he's worried there's going to be a mutiny in the ranks. He's going to get stoned to death. Well, when you get in trouble, what do? It says in verse 6, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And isn't that a perfect application? When things go really bad, what do? Pray to God and ask him to strengthen you because you're not going to make it otherwise. Here's what John Gale says, quote, David, quote, took all patiently and exercised faith on his God. He encouraged himself in the power and providence of God, in the promises of God, in his faithfulness in keeping them, in a view of his covenant relation to God, in remembrance of the grace, mercy, and goodness of God, and his former experiences of it, hoping and believing that God would appear for him in some way or another and work salvation for him. Nobody can expand on a phrase in Scripture better than John Gill can. We go down to 1 Samuel chapter 30, verses 7 and 8. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band of Amalekites? Shall I overtake them? And he, Yahweh, said to David, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all. And as we see, using the Urim and Thummim, which is in the ephod, which is in the breastplate, which is on the ephod, they heard right from the Urim and Thummim. They heard right from Yahweh, because they did. They got all the women and children and the old people and the sheep and the oxen. They got it all back, as we'll see in just a minute. Now this Abiathar, the priest that's traveling with David at this time, he had fled to David after Saul had killed all the other priests at Nob. You recall that story, 1 Samuel 22:20. But one son of Ahimelech's the high priest, who got killed. But one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Now Abiathar brought the ephod to David. That doesn't mean that David wore it in order to inquire of Yahweh. It most probably means Abiathar wore it and used the Urim and Thummim. Gill and Clark agree with that. We go down to 1 Samuel 30, verses 9 and 10. David and the 600 men with him went as far as the Wadi Besor, where 200 men who were to remain behind would stop. We'll see later they stopped because they were exhausted. They stopped, well, here it is right here, verse 10. They stopped because they were too exhausted to cross the Wadi Besor. David and 400 of the men continued in pursuit. So let's look at the map. This brook Besor, this wadi, a brook, is dry and the dry season, wet, it's a small stream in the rainy season. It extends from the Mediterranean Sea just south of Gaza, so we're pretty far south here, and then it runs all through the south desert there, through the Negev, and it goes all the way to Beersheba. It goes beyond that, even. But about 10 miles before you get to Beersheba, about 20 miles from the Mediterranean Sea, is probably where they cross. We don't know exactly. Well, I should even be that precise. It doesn't say where they cross, but that brook is a long, long, long brook, and it's about 15 miles south of Ziklag. They're at the brook. Only 400 people crossed the brook with David. That must have discouraged them. 200 men stayed behind the brook Besor because they were exhausted, as it says in verse 10. Why were they exhausted? Well, they were probably grief-stricken from losing all their wives and children. They had a long march through the desert, as I said, about 10 miles. So maybe 10 or 15 miles. Maybe they were afraid of their enemies. The text says nothing to this as to why they didn't cross that brook. If they had been afraid, the text probably would have said they would not go over, but it doesn't say that. It says they were too exhausted to cross over. So apparently 200 of David's men were not in as good a shape as the other 400. We go down to 1 Samuel 30, verses 11 and 12. Now they, that's the men of David, found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread, and he ate, and they provided him water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate, and then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Now, how did they know he was an Egyptian? Maybe from the clothes he was wearing, or maybe he identified, or maybe this is just telling in advance what was discovered by the conversation in verse 13. The man identifies himself as a young man of Egypt, and a slave, too, of an Amalekite. They revived the unconscious slave, and then they brought him to David. Why did they bring him to David? They could have just fed him and left him from humanitarian concerns. Well, possible reasons. This Egyptian may have been dressed as a soldier, and they figured they may get intelligence from him. I don't know. It says a servant of an Amalekite. I don't know why he's a soldier. He's probably a slave, as Adam Clark says. But he's not an old and homeborn slave, probably, according to Clark, but a captured slave. A homeborn slave would be treated with great kindness, would just be abandoned in the desert when he gets sick. It's pretty inhumane. The captured slaves, the slaves that the Amalekite had captured in one of their raiding expeditions, is likely to be abandoned because that slave would be an extra burden to nurse a sick slave back to health. Now, this slave was 3 days and three nights without food and water. Now, remember, 3 days and three nights means a part of the first day, the whole second day, and a part of the third day, so it really got to be closer to 2 days, and you can live that long without water, but it's kind of hard. 3 days is hard to imagine living 3 days in the wilderness without water. 1 Samuel 30, verses 13 and 14. David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he, that's the servant, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite," that'd be a slave of an Amalekite, "and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Now, to leave a sick slave in the desert was a barbarous and a cruel act. Well, that's par for the course for the Amalekites, because they were a very cruel people. And this was especially cruel since the Amalekites had plenty of booty from the raids they had just gone on. Not only Ziklag, but also the Negev of the Cherethites. Negev means south country. The Negev that belongs to Judah, south of Judah, south of Bethlehem at least, around Beersheba, maybe a little bit south of there, south of the Dead Sea, and the Negev of Caleb, south of Hebron. They got on all these raids, they had lots of booty, and they could have taken care of that slave. Now they just left him in the desert to die. Who are these Cherethites, or Cherethites, or as the NIV has, Cherethites? They were, according to Easton's, the inhabitants of southern Philistia. They were the Philistines. In other words, they're just another word for Philistines. The name is by some interpreted as meaning Cretans, and by others executioners who were ready to execute the king's sentence of death. The Cherethites were David's lifeguards, along with the Pelethites. We'll worry about who they are when we get there. So they went after the Cherethites, which would be the Philistines. And then they went out after some land that belonged to Judah of Israel, and then the Negev of Caleb that also belongs to Israel, near Hebron. Negev means south country. So now we go to 1 Samuel 30, verses 15 through 17. Then David said to him, "Will you bring me down to this band?" In other words, this band of Amalekites who left you to die in the desert. And he, the servant, says, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band." When he had brought him down, behold, they were spread. When the servant, the slave, had brought David down to the Amalekites, behold, the Amalekites were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. Now the slave says, "Swear to me by God that you won't kill me, David." David apparently did so swear because the slave took David on down to find the Amalekites. The slave says, "Swear to me by God." So you think, well, why would a slave, a pagan slave, be swearing by God? Well, Jekyll says, quote, "It is highly probable this man had no notion of Yahweh and his word or of the true God, only that there was a God, and that an oath taken by him was a solemn, sacred, and inviolable." By him, an oath taken by him was solemn, sacred, and inviolable, and might be trusted to and depended on. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate this, quote, "Whether there was still among these idolatrous tribes a lingering belief in one God, or this Egyptian wished to bind David by the God whom the Hebrews worshipped, the solemn sanction of an oath was mutually recognized." So, in other words, it's either he just has a vague idea that there's a God up there somewhere, or he's just trying to curry favor with David, says, "Swear by what you care about, David, and I'll swear the same way. Don't kill me." Now, the Egyptian logically figured he might be killed by David. After all, this Egyptian slave had helped burn Ziklag when he was with his master, the Amalekite. David, of course, impliedly does swear that he will not kill the Amalekite slave. He also said, the slave did, to David, "And you need to swear to me, David, that you won't return me to my master." Why would he not want to go back to his master? Well, this is the same master that left him to die in the desert, so he's obviously a cruel man. He doesn't want to go back to him. So when the Amalekite brought David down to the, when the slave of the Amalekite brought David down to the camp of the Amalekites, they were spread out. The word used there is spread. Spread over all the land. They were not in any military order and thus easy to attack. And this explains how David's small band of 400 could wipe them out. They were completely at ease and not on any kind of military alert. The Philistines were way up north attacking Israel at Mount Gilboa in the Jezreel Valley. And the Amalekites thought David was with the Philistines, so they look at Ziklag. It's totally undefended. There's not a soldier there, so they're at ease. They're not worried about anybody attacking them, so this was a complete surprise attack by David. And when you get attacked in your camp, that's bad business. That's a massacre waiting to happen. Now, there's a question here of how long David took to slaughter all these Amalekites. It says, from twilight until the evening of the next day. And you read that, you think, he attacks at dusk, and then he fights all night, and then he fights the next day until evening. Well, that can't be. I mean, that just can't be. Now, John Gill explains that twilight can mean either twilight at evening or twilight in the morning, so it could be dawn. Well, that leads to an ambiguity of how long David attacked. The first option is the one I just mentioned, the one it sounds like, from dusk of one day to the evening of the next, which means he would be fighting into the nighttime all night long, then all the next day, and I don't believe that. The other option is he's fighting from the morning, twilight of the morning, in other words, the dawn of one day, until the evening of that same day, in other words, all day long, and that makes more sense. Now, some speculate that David arrived in the evening and did not attack, waited all night, let the Amalekites get good and drunk and asleep before they attacked early in the morning. Ellicott says this, Kyle, referring to the Kyle and Delitzsch Kyle, thinks the fighting went on from the evening twilight to the evening of the next day, and as I said, I don't really believe that. Bishop Hervey, in the speaker's commentary, with greater probability, supposes that the twilight is the morning twilight, as the contrast between twilight and evening rather suggests. David thus arrived at night, and finding his enemies eating and drinking, put off his attack until the morning dawn or twilight, when they would still be sleeping after their debauch. Although thus taken by surprise, their great numbers and their natural bravery enabled them to prolong the fierce struggle all through the day. That's another thing, too. It wasn't just because it was a surprise attack doesn't mean that David wiped them out with his 400 men. He had a hard battle to fight all day long, but he won it. And then it says in verse 17 that not a man of the Amalekites escaped except 400 young men. And what that means is didn't escape the slaughter, because obviously 400 men did escape on camels and took off. So that means David wiped out all the soldiers to a man. It was well known that the Amalekites were proscribed people. I mean, the Amalekites, they're like Nazis to us. They attacked Israel at Rephidim on the Exodus. They were allied with Midian and Moab on the plains of Moab as Moses is trying to get the Israelites ready to cross over the Jordan River. And then they start having adulterous sex with the Midianites. You recall that story on the plains of Moab in Deuteronomy. Well, the Amalekites were allied with those Midianites and those Moabites. They were the three. So they're constant, and they were also, well, God had, I forgot the scripture, but there was a scripture where God told the Israelites, you got to wipe these guys out. And then, of course, yeah, the story of Saul and Samuel said, you need to wipe the Amalekites out. Saul didn't do it, but Samuel wanted him to. So the Amalekites were some evil dudes, and David, at least in this little confrontation, he wiped them out. We go down to 1 Samuel 30, verses 18 and 20. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. That's Ahinoam and Abigail. Nothing was missing, small or great, booty or sons or daughters, of all that the Amalekites had taken. David brought back everything. Moreover, David took all the sheep and oxen. As they drove these before him, they shouted, "This is David's spoil." Now, I'm using the New American Bible translation here for a reason. David recovered everything. Now, that everything includes two portions of spoil. First is the portion of David's men that had gotten stolen from Ziklag. That was one portion. Then there's also all the spoil that the Philistines had taken from their other raids. The raids on the Negev of Caleb, the Negev of Judah, and the Negev of the Kerethites. They were on a long raiding expedition. They were just chock full of spoil. And David got it all. Brought it back to Ziklag. Now, verse 20 is interesting. Moreover, David took all the sheep and oxen as they drove these before him. They shouted, "This is David's spoil." What's going on here? Well, first of all, I told you I used the New American Bible translation. That's because verse 20 in the King James and the New American Standard Bible and the Home of Christian Study Bible is unintelligible because they add a word which is not in the original Hebrew. And, for example, I'll read the Home of Christian Study Bible and see if you can make any sense of it. He, that's David, took all the sheep and cattle, which was driven ahead of the other livestock, and the people shouted, "This is David's plunder." He took all the sheep and cattle, which were driven ahead of the other livestock. Well, here's what the commentators say about this. Ellicott says, in the English translation, the word "which," inserted in italics, obscures the sense. The literal reading is, "And David took all the flocks and herds and drove them before their cattle, and this is David's spoil." Cambridge commentator says, this verse as it stands admits of no satisfactory explanation. The pulpit commentary says, this verse, which is made unintelligible in the authorized version, that's the King James, it's made unintelligible by the insertion of the unauthorized word, which, that verse is really free from difficulty. Well, I finally found a translation that made pretty good sense. The New American Bible says, David took all the sheep and oxen and drove those before him. And then the people were shouting, of course, this is David's spoil. So here's what happened. Remember that the spoil is divided into two sections. There's the spoil that was taken from David's men from Ziklag, and then there's the spoil that the Amalekites had gotten on their raiding parties to other places. And what happened was, is the Amalekite sheep were driven in front. The Ziklag sheep and oxen were driven in back of the Amalekite sheep. And so the Amalekite sheep in front were said to be, by the people as they shouted, said to be, this is David's spoil. In other words, the sheep and oxen in the front belonged to David. He got them from the Amalekite spoil. But of course, the sheep and oxen in the rear, that's just returning the sheep and oxen that were stolen from us. Ellicott says the same thing, has it that way. That's very obscure. It's a little bit difficult to see, but that makes more sense to me. It makes sense because the people are now distinguishing out, this is David's spoil. David would not get the spoil that was stolen from his soldiers at Ziklag. So the spoil that David is getting must be the spoil that he took from the Amalekites, who had gotten that spoil from other cities besides Ziklag. Now notice the men now who just recently wanted to stone David. Now they were happy to let David have the honor of owning the spoil. Isn't it amazing how Success breeds success. How victory breeds victory. Nothing like it. 1 Samuel 30, verses 21 through 25. When David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to go with him and had been left at the Wadi Besor, they came out to meet him and to meet the troops with him. When David approached the men, he greeted them. But all the corrupt and worthless men among those who had gone with David argued, "Because they didn't go with us, we will not give any of the plunder we recovered to them except for each man's wife and children." In other words, we keep the sheep and the oxen. You can take your wife and children back. We're not going to steal those from you. How nice. They, the 200 at the Wadi Besor, they may take them, take their wife and children, and go. But David said, "My brothers, you must not do this with what the Lord has given us, with what the Lord has given us. He protected us and handed over to us the raiders who came against us. Who can agree to your proposal? The share of the one who goes into battle is to be the same as the share of the one who remains with the supplies. They will share equally." And it has been so from that day forward. David established this policy as a law and an ordinance for Israel, and it continues to this very day. Now, these corrupt and worthless men who went down with David to attack the Amalekites, how many of them, of the 400, were corrupt and worthless? The NIV Study Bible says it could have been a majority. Well, you remember, it was a bunch of debtors and freeloaders that joined up with David to start with, as well as some family members. And so he was leading, a flawed group of people. Now, these men are called corrupt and worthless, the stingy ones who didn't want to give any of the plunder to the 200 who stayed at the brook. Now, on the surface of it, you think, well, people stayed at the brook. They didn't fight. Why shouldn't they get it? Well, here's the argument why they should have been given a share of the plunder, especially since some of that plunder had been stolen from them originally, from Ziklag. Why should they get a share? Well, they had performed a military function in guarding the baggage train. The 400 were lighter as they attacked, having left all their baggage back in the baggage train. The 200 behind guarded the pass over the brook Besor, the Wadi Besor. A party could have crossed that brook and attacked the 400 men of David from the rear as they were trying to attack the Amalekites. And so that means these 200 men who were left behind guarding the baggage train and guarding the passes across the Wadi Besor, they were exposed to danger. And besides, they didn't willfully refuse to cross the brook Besor. They were exhausted. They couldn't cross. So David made a wise decision here. Can you imagine the dissension in the army if his men had gotten away with not sharing the plunder with the 200, especially since they had their property taken from them at Ziklag? They were penniless. Now, for the 400 to say, "Depart, go," that really was cruel, because the 200 would depart poverty-stricken. They had nowhere to go. Ziklag was burnt down. They couldn't go back to Israel. They would be at the mercy of Saul, who would kill them for having fought with David. Of course, they didn't know that Saul had been killed up at Mount Gibeon, but as far as they were concerned, Saul was still alive, and they weren't going to go back to him. But the 400 of David's corrupt and worthless men, they didn't care. They didn't care where these 200 might go. They just wanted to get rid of them. Why? So they could get a bigger share of the spoil. Greed. Now, David, in verse 23, pulls off a great political victory. First of all, he calls them brothers. "My brothers, you must not do this." Even though they're corrupt and worthless, David calls them brothers. He's using all his leadership skills to hold his motley band together. And here's his argument in verse 23. "My brothers, you must not do this with what the Lord has given us." Now, emphasize the Lord there, Yahweh. What he's saying is, look, it wasn't your clever skill, your fighting martial abilities that allowed you to get this spoil. It was Yahweh who did it for you. So the honor of the victory does not belong only to you, 400, so neither does the spoil belong only to you. You need to share it. And in fact, it says in verse 24, "Who can agree to your proposal?" The way we would say it is, who in the world would agree to such an idiotic proposal? No wise and just man would side with the 400. And so this practice of sharing all booty with the people who guard the baggage train became a law and an ordinance in verse 25, even to this day. This day means the book was long written after the facts it commemorates, written long after Samuel's death. Samuel had died at this time. It was probably the late 11th century B.C. as you approach 1000 B.C. And many seem to think Samuel was written as you approach 900 B.C., late 10th century B.C., about 100 years later. But at any rate, it became a custom to share the spoil with non-combatants. We go down to 1 Samuel 30, verse 26. "Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah. to his friends, saying, "Behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." And David came back to Ziklag, apparently with the intention to rebuild the city. Some houses may have escaped the flames, as Jahiel says, and of course David's men could pitch tents there while they rebuilt the city. Now, why did David send portions of the plunder of the Amalekites to the elders of Judah? Well, here's some possible reasons. First of all, he perhaps wanted to compensate Judah for losses suffered by the Amalekites. Judah bore the brunt of those raids. They were in the south, and Judah's in the south. Other tribes of Israel didn't suffer like Judah did. Another reason might be to thank those who had supported him in his flight from Saul. Remember, there were towns in Judah that put him up as he ran from place to place. And we notice that in the list of towns, in verses 27 through 30, Ziph and Keilah are not mentioned, because those were the two towns that had tried to betray David to Saul, as we looked at in a couple of audios previous. So he didn't send them gifts, but he didn't try to exact vengeance on Ziph and Keilah either. I'm sure that was for political reasons, too. He might need their support later on. So that's option number two. It's a thank you gift for those who helped him flee from Saul. Option number three, David was trying to smooth his way to the throne. He realized Saul was finished, and so he starts giving out presents, kind of like the way political leaders, presidents, give out patronage to their supporters, ambassadorships, and that sort of thing. You can't give money out because that's illegal, but you give jobs, give patronage. So maybe that's what David was doing. The NIV Study Bible says that's another reason David sent gifts out, a fourth reason. These gifts provided an alibi against any accusations that David had fought with the Philistines against Israel. "What do you mean I'm fighting against you? I just gave you presents. How can you say such a terrible thing?" Well, whatever his reasons were, the effect of the gifts was positive. Large numbers of followers came to David's camp now, 1 Chronicles 12:22. "For day by day men came to David to help him until there was a great army like the army of God." So we go now to 1 Samuel 30, verses 27 through 30. This is a list of the places that received gifts. I'm going to float over this kind of quickly. "To those who were in Bethel, and to those who were in Ramoth of the Negev, and to those who were in Jatir, and to those who were in Arar, and to those who were in Siphmoth, and to those who were in Eshtemoah, and to those who were in Rakal, and to those who were in the cities of the Jeremelites, and to those who were in the cities of the Kenites, and to those who were in Hormah, and to those who were in Borshan, and to those who were in Aphek." Now, some of these places might be familiar. Most of them are not, but it's a lot of them. You can see he gave out a lot of gifts. It's a lot of politicking going on. James Fawcett Brown says the enumeration of all these cities shows what a numerous and influential party David could count on. And in other places, many, but not all, but many of these cities are mentioned in other scriptures as belonging to Judah. Now, quickly, a few comments. For those who are in Bethel, that's probably the famous Bethel right north of Jerusalem. Gill says it could be Kiriath-Jearim because Bethel means house of God, and the ark was being kept at Kiriath-Jearim, so maybe that's symbolically or figuratively referring to Kiriath-Jearim. I don't think so. Probably just Bethel, the Bethel and Ephraim, where Jacob saw the angels going up and down the ladder. Ararar, there now the most famous Ararar is beyond the Jordan River on the northern banks of the Arnon River, but Adam Clark says that's who David gave gifts to. But why would he be giving gifts over there to a pagan tribe? I don't think so. John Gill says it's some city in the tribe of Judah where they haven't really located it. I think I saw it with a question mark on BibleAtlas.org. So it's some city in Judah. It's not across the Dead Sea in Moab. Eshtemoah is a Levitical city given to the Levites by Judah. The Jeremelites, they've been brought up before in 1 Samuel 27. They are a tribe of Judah that lay to the south, or family, a clan of Judah that lay to the south of Judah. Now the Kenites are mentioned as receiving gifts, as well as they should, because they're famous for being friendly with the Israelites. Let me go over Eastern's dictionary description of them. The word means smiths. They inhabited the desert line between southern Palestine and the mountains of Sinai. That's Arabia Petraea. Jethro, that's Moses' father-in-law, was a Kenite. He was called a Midianite, but Jethro's also called a Kenite, too, so that's why people say that Midianites and Kenites are probably the same people. They were wandering smiths, the gypsies, and traveling tinkers of the old Oriental world. They showed kindness to Israel in their journey through the wilderness. They accompanied Israel in their march as far as Jericho, and then they returned to their old haunts among the Amalekites. That's down in the southern area in the desert down there. The Rechabites, those famous tribe of giants, belonged to the tribe of Kenites. And then, of course, they were living with the Amalekites in the southern Negev when Saul said, "How about leave the Amalekites, because I'm getting ready to kill them." Why did Saul say that? Because you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. One other place that David spread his largesse to was Hormah, which means destruction. The general name of those cities which belonged to Arad, king of Canaan, were devoted to destruction by the Hebrews, and thus called Hormah, Numbers 21. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with David's redeeming of his leadership. He's been saved from Achish in the last chapter. He's been saved from his own men in this chapter. He beats the Amalekites. He's now doing the political spade work in order to get him taken as king in the kingdom, especially since Saul has now been killed up at Gilboa, which we'll look at in the next chapter. So we are prepared to go to the next chapter, chapter 31, verses 1 through 13, which we will entitle The Death of Saul. I hope you can stay tuned for that sad event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.